painel, a formação da política externa, novas realidades, diferentes atores. Temos connosco o professor Brian Hawking, que será apresentado pela senhora professora Maria João Seabra, investigadora do Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos, a quem dou desde já a palavra, agradecendo a sua presença e o seu contributo nesta conferência.
Muito obrigada, Presidente. Eu gostaria, obviamente, em primeiro lugar, em relação a este painel, de agradecer a presença do professor Brian Hawking, que é, de facto, um especialista com uma longa lista de publicações e trabalho feito na questão dos atores, dos novos atores da política externa. E devo dizer que quando convidámos o professor Brian Hawking para estar aqui presente, a ideia era precisamente ver como é que, com todas as alterações da cena internacional, com as novas dinâmicas da política internacional, como é que se conjuga, de facto, a atuação dos diferentes atores. O que suponho que seja uma questão central e também, obviamente, para Portugal, é, no fundo, se é possível ou não articular a ação das ONGs, a ação das empresas, a ação das regiões, a ação das próprias comunidades migrantes, ou seja, uma série de novos atores que adquirem um determinado estatuto e um determinado poder e um determinado papel em termos das relações externas. E, portanto, estamos aqui a ultrapassar aquilo que seria até há algum tempo um domínio quase que exclusivo dos Estados soberanos. Sem me alongar mais, eu passava então a palavra ao professor Brian Hawking, que de facto tem estado muito concentrado na questão da interação precisamente entre as questões internas e externas da formulação da política externa e como é que os novos atores interagem na cena internacional. Brian, da Pfizer.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. Let me say immediately how honoured I am to be invited here by the Institute and by the Parliament and to have the opportunity to engage with you in the important discussions which we've started this morning. And let me say immediately that my specialist knowledge of Portugal and Portuguese foreign policy is not particularly well developed, but I am conscious of the fact of the significant historic international role that Portugal has played, and of course of the very significant and deep relationship between my country, the United Kingdom, and Portugal historically. In the discussion that we've had so far this morning and the various contributions, not least that, of course, by Robert Matthews, we've focused very much on significant issues. Critical issues, not, of course, simply relating to the position or the interests of individual states, nor collectivities of states such as the European Union, but of the global community. What I'm going to talk about really picks up on some of the themes that have came out of Robert Matthews' presentation and of the earlier presentations, which perhaps can be summarized quite simply by the phrase process matters. That is to say, alongside these significant issues, these problems which we confront, how we confront them, how we configure policy processes is a very significant. The points made latterly in his presentation by Robert Matthews about the issues of coordination, the issue of prediction, in a sense of intelligence gathering and processing intelligence. These are issues that are very much issues of process. They therefore raise these general issues of new realities of foreign policy, whatever that phrase might mean, and they also raise the questions about who's involved in those processes. Now, just briefly by way of background, let me say that I've spent a bit of time over the last 5 or 10 years looking at these issues at several levels, and in the last 2 or 3 years, specifically in the context of how ministries of foreign affairs are seeking to reconfigure themselves in dealing with the problems of a far more complex international but also domestic environment. It has struck me that in many ways these issues, these problems, are perceived in not dissimilar terms by very different countries. 2 years ago, I was invited by the Danish Foreign Ministry to join a working group considering the impact of globalization on Danish foreign policy. Now, of course, globalization is a word that we can all grasp. It means something, but maybe, in essence, it means very little when one comes to actually grapple with its significance. The working group produced a report. You can find it on the website of the Danish Foreign Ministry. I'm not recommending that you actually go to read it, but I'm simply making the point that alongside other foreign ministries, I've done work with my own foreign ministry, the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and such diverse ministries as, say, the German Federal Foreign Office and the Thai Foreign Ministry. And as I say, what interests me is the commonality of concern and interest. And it's some of those points that I want to try and pull out of that discussion and hopefully relate those to some of the issues that have been raised in earlier presentations this morning. New realities, I think, poses the obvious question about what is new and what is old, or, to put it another way, the balance between change and continuity. Much of what we deem to be new in this context, of course, has its roots in quite complex interrelationships between continuing patterns and what we and emerging change in the context both of domestic and international policy. One question, I guess, that we could raise at the very beginning is just how useful it is to retain the term foreign policy. Now, I don't want to be particularly controversial here, and there are obvious arguments for retaining familiar labels, but the point that I want to make, firstly, is this, that the issues that are subsumed under foreign policy, as I think emerged so clearly in Robert Matthews' presentation, are highly complex. issues of the traditional foreign policy agenda of military security are linked with issues of the environment, of human rights now, of food security, of a whole range of health security, how we respond to the prospect of pandemics. All these things are interlinked in a way that makes the management of them, if we can manage them, very difficult, but also poses the obvious reality that what we think of as domestic policy issues and foreign policy issues are now even less separated and less clear than might have been the case, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Acting internationally requires the capacity to act domestically. Migration is an obvious example of this, and one of the interesting phenomena that you find in many foreign ministries is the change in responsibility within government given to issues relating to migration, with shifts between ministries of the interior and foreign ministries on this very critical issue. New realities then, firstly, poses questions about issues. Secondly, it poses questions about arenas, where foreign policy actually operates. As I've just suggested, that is an issue that is subject to increasing debate. Negotiating internationally demands effective domestic negotiation. This, to a degree, has always been true, but given the growing complexities of the global regional agendas, it's becoming even more true. One perspective, as I've already said, in terms of thinking about these arenas is to think of them in a global sense. The impact of what is termed globalization has dominated to a considerable degree official but also popular and media thinking and presentation of the realities of foreign policy that confront us. What I want to suggest, though, is that that has to be seen alongside other trends as well. Globalization exists and develops alongside the processes of regionalization, of course, of which we're familiar here in the European context through the European Union, but of course there are many other examples of regionalization as a foreign policy phenomenon around the world. Indeed, regionalization, one can argue, is one of the world's biggest growth industries. But alongside those two things, alongside globalization and regionalization, one also has localization. And what I mean by that is the growing interest and involvement of subnational entities and actors in international affairs. This isn't a new reality. These things have been with us for 30 or 40 years, where Canada is very familiar, as is Spain, with the issue of regional, of non-central governmental interests in international affairs. In the United States, it's interesting there that in the absence, almost the creation of a vacuum on the climate change issue, this critical environmental issue, the baton of progress, if one takes the view that this is progress, and I certainly do, towards dealing with this critical issue has been picked up by a number of state governments and city authorities within the United States. Putting these things together then, what we confront, what this new reality presents us with, is not simply globalization, it's not even regionalization, but it's a complexity of interrelationships that I would term a polycentric policy environment. In other words, there are lots of centers of political, economic, and social interest that are concerned with how these issues are developed and how they are dealt with. Well, against that general background, we're confronted with the third dimension, and one that I was asked particularly to address, and this is the issue of actors in foreign policy, or who it is that is involved. I think that the first point to make here is that for all actors, whether they are multilateral agencies, regional groupings, national governments, or whether they're non-governmental organizations, or indeed business enterprises, there's a general issue that the complexities of international and domestic political life, I would suggest, present them with, and most generally express that problem is one of policy capacity, the ability to actually achieve the goals and manage the responsibilities that those particular actors, of whatever kind they are, seek to achieve. And at the end of the day, many of the problems and the issues that Robert Matthews was addressing earlier this morning are issues of policy capacity looked at from different perspectives and through different lenses. The United Nations confronts these issues. The reform of the UN is, as we know, is a long-standing issue, as it is for the World Trade Organization in a different context. And interestingly, one of the critical issues for the World Trade Organization is how to manage its relationships with more assertive non-governmental interests. Non-governmental interests who want a voice in the relatively closed environment of multilateral trade negotiations. The issue of policy capacity, how to do the job, how to achieve goals, is an issue, as we've heard earlier this morning, for the European Union in the context of the Lisbon Treaty and the proposed European External Action Service. When one cuts through the complexities of the European External Active Service, or the proposed service, or when I say complexities, the actual treaty says relatively little about a European External Action Service. This is a question about organizing the European Union to achieve its external policy responsibilities in a way that those who would want to see those more effectively deployed at a European level might be developed. Let me move on then quickly to the more specific level, a level at which Portugal joins a range of other national governments around the world in trying to grapple with the issue of its own responsibilities as a foreign policy actor. As I said at the beginning, I've spent a little time focusing on these questions of working with foreign ministries, in particular on the question of adaptation of the structures of these organizations to deal with changing environments. I think there's an overarching theme that probably emerges from the way that many foreign ministries have come to view their work in the context of this changing policy environment. And that context can be perhaps summarized in terms of a shift away from a traditional image of foreign policy as a hierarchical activity with a very limited number of participants, insulated from the realities of domestic political life, different in terms of its processes, and different in terms, certainly in bureaucratic terms, of its culture. Foreign ministries and diplomatic services are very often accused, or have been accused in the past, of being remote elites that are separated from the processes and realities reflected in organization institutions such as that in which we're now seated, namely national parliaments. And of course, it is one of the functions of parliamentary foreign affairs committees to ensure that this insulation and separation is modified. But I think my sense is that there is a very willing constituency that recognizes that this hierarchical set of structures and modes of operation are now no longer relevant to the kinds of problems that are confronting the national governments, or indeed, as I said earlier, multilateral organizations and regional organizations, and that what is actually needed is to establish networks between policy actors of a wide range of responsibility and with very different characteristics. Networks, policy networks, have become a very familiar concept over recent years. And one of the essences of policy networks is the capacity to trade expertise and resources between different kinds of policy actor. Again, going back to what we've been looking at earlier today, this is really one of the critical issues. How do you bring together the skills, expertise, and responsibilities of such actors as, on the one hand, a set of national governments, multilateral agencies, and non-governmental organizations of a whole range of forms and responsibilities, of Amnesty International, of Oxfam. Organizations which have proliferated in number over the last 20 years, to such an extent that it is now impossible, according to most people, to actually offer any realistic assessment of how many non-governmental organizations there are. From the perspective of national governments, then, the issue becomes one of building sets of relationships between constituencies whom traditionally have not been part of the foreign policy landscape. Part of that changing landscape actually exists within government itself. One of the biggest issues for the foreign ministry is recognizing and responding to the fact that what are sometimes called other government departments, that is to say, departments other than the foreign ministry who have international interests and international responsibilities, have to be coordinated within a country's overall interface with its international environment. Hence, most, or many, perhaps it's, perhaps I'm pushing too hard in saying most, but I think probably it is most. Most foreign ministries have come to redefine their role, not as the lead agency in terms of managing foreign policy, but in terms of what most frequently is termed the coordinator of a state's more complex set of relationships with the outside world. The term that has become very popular and very familiar in this area, as in others, is that of stakeholder. Foreign policy is seen increasingly as managing relationships with a multiplicity of stakeholders. If you think about the traditional image of foreign policy as being expressed in terms of a closed or a club model, relatively exclusive, with its prescribed rules presided over by a relatively small elite, the emphasis now is on building relationships with as broad a set of constituencies as are required for dealing with the problems at hand. To return for a moment, just by way of example, to my own country, the United Kingdom, the British Foreign Office, or Foreign and Commonwealth Office, to give it its correct title, has spent a good deal of time over the last 2 years in looking very intensively at its relationship with a broad range of stakeholders. In fact, it brought in the head of Oxfam's international division to work with a unit to revise and the Foreign Office's relationship both within government circles, relationship with other government departments, which were redefined not as other government departments, but as partners, as partner departments, but also outside the realm of government with non-governmental organizations. What I think this represents, then, in terms of thinking about how governments relate to their international environments, is firstly recognizing the fact that if there is something called foreign policy, and we're going to retain the term foreign policy because it's a familiar term and it means something, but the content of foreign policy has far removed from traditional definitions and traditional images. The content is complex, it's shifting, it's changing, and it's hard to get a grasp of. In order to deal with that, as I've suggested, what governments are doing and what they need to do more of is to develop networks of relationships with constituencies both within their own countries and outside their own countries in order to achieve policy objectives. My final point then is this, I guess. It's that in the context of globalization, it's not that the state is becoming irrelevant. This was a popular view a few years ago in the first wave of globalization literature and writings. The state was irrelevant. The future lay either above the state in terms of the activities of multilateral bodies, of regional organizations. Perhaps it lay below the state in terms of the interests, international interests and activities of sub-state actors. Or perhaps, as another option, the functions of the state were being emptied to and moved towards either overpowerful multinational business enterprises or non-governmental organizations, which, as I've said, have proliferated in recent years. Going back to my earlier point, however, I think what the evidence of the last few years has demonstrated is that no one actor, no one entity has the capacity to provide the solutions to the kinds of problems we were discussing this morning. But the problem becomes one of establishing within the kind of network policy environment which demands linkages between a range of actors and strategies for managing those relationships, but only that kind of strategy can deal with the kinds of complexities that governments and other agencies around the world now confront. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigada, Brian. Sem querer, obviamente, resumir uma exposição tão interessante, mas basicamente tivemos na primeira sessão uma enorme complexidade de problemas e desafios, e aquilo que temos agora é que para responder a esses desafios, de facto, há uma complexidade não só de atores, mas também de palcos, e sobretudo, portanto, o que temos é uma questão de articulação. Mas pela conclusão, pela forma como o Brian O'Kane concluiu, acho que há aqui uma constatação que pode ser, que é extremamente que é interessante reter, sobretudo quando se fala nos Estados e quando se fala nas instituições internacionais, é esta espécie de consciencialização de que nenhuma entidade sozinha, portanto estaremos a falar de Estados ou de instituições ou de instituições internacionais ou subregionais, seja o que for, nenhuma entidade sozinha tem capacidade para resolver os problemas. E, portanto, não estamos perante uma realidade que impõe, de facto, sobretudo, uma questão de articulação e de coordenação entre a multiplicidade de atores. Nós ainda temos algum tempo disponível para debate e, portanto, eu abria agora para quem quisesse fazer os comentários. professor José Francisco Pavia.
Bom dia, muito obrigado pela exposição, muito interessante. A minha pergunta é muito rápida e direta, basicamente tendo em conta o seguinte. Segundo eu depreendi da sua exposição, considera que esta nova forma de fazer diplomacia, enfim, a que já foi dado o nome de multi-track diplomacy, no sentido em que há vários atores, que não só os Estados, que, no fundo, concorrem para essa diplomacia, e acha que, no fundo, isso é positivo, segundo eu depreendi das suas palavras. A minha pergunta é muito simples. Não poderemos estar em risco de, havendo uma série de atores não estatais que concorrem na diplomacia e na execução da política externa, de haver uma espécie de diplomacia paralela que, de algum modo, porá em causa a coerência da política externa dos Estados?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. I think that this is something that national governments and other agencies too, but also non-governmental organisations themselves are concerned with. I mean, we tend to think, or perhaps the popular impression has been created over the years, that somehow or other non-governmental organisations are better at doing the job than our states. And I think there's a lot of evidence now that questions whether or not this is the case. There's enough evidence out there in the field to demonstrate that the activities of NGOs, if uncoordinated, and very often they are uncoordinated, are as problematic as is a national government's lack of coordination. I think there are problems, and I think governments are aware of that, and I think this is one of the critical debates very often that's going on within government. How do you actually present a reasonably coherent face to the outside world? Now, I don't think one should overstate the importance of coherence, or indeed the value of coherence. I mean, sometimes incoherence, where that's associated with constructive debate and difference of viewpoint, can be a positive feature. But at the point of delivery, somebody has got to actually bring these things together. As I said a few minutes ago, this, I think, is where foreign ministries now see their niche. This is why the stress... I've got shelves of documents from foreign ministries which seem, I think, to be agreed on the point that if there's one thing left for a foreign ministry to do, it's to coordinate, particularly between the governmental agencies. Of course, the difficult thing is that historically there are powerful government departments who don't want to be coordinated. Historically, particularly where international trade is a separate function, historically trade departments have been in tension with foreign ministry departments. And I have to confess, I'm not sure in the case of Portugal whether trade is part of foreign ministry or not. So multi-track diplomacy reflected at the domestic level is something clearly that has to be managed. There have to be processes in place that achieve, that seek to deliver policy capacity in any particular area, and I think that that's what imperfectly or relatively, with varying degrees of success, governments around the world are actually grappling with. It's interesting, just finally, Robert Matthews was talking earlier about public diplomacy, and this has become one of the huge preoccupations of foreign ministries. I mean, particularly the State Department, and the State Department seems seems to me to be an inverse relationship between the capacity of the United States to deliver effective public diplomacy and the amount of time it spends actually talking about it. But you know, this is all part of this broader issue of how you manage a more complex environment with a range of interests and actors, and recognizing, because fundamentally what public diplomacy is recognizing, is that you can't achieve your strategic objectives without addressing constituencies that are not governments overseas. So I'm sorry, that's a rather long reply to what was a very concise and well-focused question, and I apologize.
Yeah, Miguel Santos.
Thank you, Professor Woking. First of all, I'd like to thank you for a very interesting and stimulating presentation. I probably two issues I would like to ask you to elaborate a little more. One which I think is very, very important is the implications of the fact that the boundaries between the domestic and the external have been blurred, and this poses new challenges for governments and for other actors. And there is an interesting experience from your own country, the UK, which I would ask you if you could explain a little bit more what has been the outcome, which is the creation of the UK Invest. It's not only a combination between the Ministry of the FCO and the Ministry of Trade, but it has also developed, first of all, a network of internal offices that work with the firms inside the UK, and then naturally this extends to the actions outside. And this is completely a new paradigm in terms of action, which I think it's very interesting and illustrates your point. The second issue relates to the fact that these networks you mentioned about, the policy networks, have to be seen in the context of a new emerging paradigm of the knowledge society, because this is not specific to the foreign policy. It's something which is true for all policy areas and for the emergence of a more holistic approach to policy making. And the question there is, to what extent you see, in terms of international multilateral organizations, the possibility of this new reality of new actors in international system being absorbed, because you mentioned WTO. This is a critical case where you see a resistance of international system to adapt to this new reality. The famous cases of the amicus curiae briefs and other developments. So what chances you see of developments in that area?
Thank you. thank you very much for those questions. I have to confess that I haven't looked at UK Invest very closely, but I have talked to one or two people who have been involved in it, and I think it's part of a broader phenomenon that has been pursued as a deliberate strategy within the UK in terms of reinforcing relationships between business and the foreign policy bureaucracy, if you like, if one wishes to put it that way. I suppose looked at in the most pragmatic fashion, the level of inward investment into the United Kingdom is one measure of the success and the way in which these things are managed. And although there have been some variations recently in terms of that, Britain still remains a significant target for inward foreign investment. But the broader point that I just wanted to refer to is looked at in the broader context of developing relationships with different interest communities or stakeholders. The British Foreign Office has also operated what has been a very successful exchange scheme between middle ranking business people and members of the Foreign Office. Indeed, a few years ago, it was so successful that it was difficult to actually fund that that program. But it is part of this broader context of the blurring of domestic and external issues, as you said. On the second point that you raised, the issue of networks and how multilateral agencies respond to the demands of non-governmental organisations for a greater voice. This is quite a complicated. This is a much more complicated issue, I think, than is sometimes presented. Because if one takes the example of the World Trade Organization that you've just alluded to, I think that often this is seen as a situation where a reluctant World Trade Organization is refusing to give a greater voice to the legitimate claims of non-governmental organisations. Now, the first point, perhaps, is the obvious one, that there has been some changes there, that NGOs have, at least at the margins, a greater access. But there is a political reality underpinning this, and the political reality is simply reflects the complexities that we've been of international affairs that we've been talking about, namely that many developing countries are highly suspicious of the activities of non-governmental organisations in the WTO. In fact, I've had a number of conversations with the person within the WTO Secretariat who is responsible for managing relationships with NGOs, and one of his main problems is not dealing with the NGOs, it's dealing with developing countries who are deeply opposed to giving a greater voice to NGOs because they believe, and they may or may not be right in believing this, that non-governmental organizations are really the creatures of developed countries. They give a greater voice, greater emphasis. So there is a problem here, and it's one that I think will be worked out gradually, like all these problems. The United Nations, of course, has been grappling with this issue ever since it was founded, and has gone far further down the road in terms of giving voice and presence to NGOs. But there is, as I say, there's political realities that have to be accommodated here in actually working out how these, the complexities of these relationships will be dealt with over time.
Thank you very much. My name is Ahara, a Japanese ambassador to Portugal. Well, my question is twofold. One is, I have had rather long experience in the Japanese Foreign Service in struggling to make good coordinations on the Japanese foreign policies with other ministries, particularly. First question is, there are two basic ideas on the position or status of the foreign ministry. One is, of course, one among the equals. The other is a slightly higher position, closer to the Prime Minister's office or President's office. In your, say, speciality in, working with various foreign ministries, what is your opinion on what kind of status is to be given to the Minister of Foreign Affairs to achieve very efficient and good coordination among various stakeholders within the government, say, among equals, or, say, slightly higher status, close to the Prime Minister's office? Second question is, if you look at the diversity of various foreign issues, as you have illustrated, the issues are diversified tremendously. And in this sense, in the case of, for example, environment, there is a view that the environment ministry should be given that position to coordinate government policies. Or in the case of WTO, it's not the foreign ministry, but the trade ministry. In that sense, if that comes true, then, of course, the integration of the foreign policy of the government may not be achieved. There is such a view. I'd like to hear your opinion on that. Thank you.
thank you, Ambassador. I keep using the phrase complex problems, but I use the word deliberately because they are difficult issues, and of course the answer to them is not to be found in any rational model. They reflect the political cultures and the bureaucratic cultures of particular countries. I'm not an expert on Japan, but I am conscious of the fact that historically there have been very significant tensions between foreign ministry and, say, MITI, your trade, international trade ministry. In terms of the first question that you pose, the question of status and how do you rank the foreign ministry, I think my response to that is that probably dealing with the kinds of issues that we've been examining this morning is probably not going to be resolved by a simple formula that says, well, the foreign ministry is the premier department. I've spent in the context of some other work that I was doing, I've spent some time talking in London to the people in the embassies of EU member states. And I did this because I was intrigued to know how they saw their role. Why does France and why does Germany and why does Austria have an ambassador in London? One more purpose to me. The kinds of discussions that I have, I think, are somewhat relevant to your question, in as much as the responses that I tended to get from diplomats was that
the way in which foreign international policy is managed, even within the context of the European Union, is being worked out in a way that develops a kind of a flexible managerial form in which prime ministers' departments,
if you use the phraseology of Britain, the Cabinet Office, coordinating agencies like that have specific important roles on particular agenda items and in particular contexts. More generally, though,
there is a recognition that you have to have a process by which different interests are reconciled when it comes to the point of dealing with the international environment. And that is partially achieved by recognizing that the diplomatic service is not the voice of the foreign ministry. The diplomatic service is the platform for the whole of government. And one of the interesting things I think that's going on in most countries is to redefine the relationship between missions, posts, diplomatic posts, and the home government, how communication works between the two. And that is done on a pragmatic, way. The second point that you raised, which is related to that, is the question of functional responsibilities which impinge on international issues. Well, I think the answer to the question, shouldn't the Environment Ministry have the lead in terms of environmental negotiations, is probably that it does have the lead. Well, in many countries it would be the case. It would certainly be the case in Britain that the Department of the Environment would be recognised as the lead agency in a kind of negotiation. But the question is, what kind of consultative processes are built into the system, into what I would call the national diplomatic system, which comprises all these interests and all these agencies? It is how this is structured. Some countries deliberately have tried to achieve coordination through a very hierarchical system, which asserts the preeminence of the foreign ministry. I question whether that is likely to be successful in the longer term, given the complexity of the kinds of issues that countries confront and the global community confronts. Thank you.
Muito obrigado. Nós chegámos ao limite do nosso tempo e para ser pelo menos tão pontual como o Dr. José Lameco me precedeu, só me resta de facto agradecer ao professor Brian O'King e agradecer a todos os que aqui estão e obviamente que ficámos ainda com muitas questões para debates futuros que estou certa que realizaremos. Muito obrigada.
Muito obrigado. Passaríamos agora à fase de encerramento, no que eu daria a palavra ao Dr. Figueiredo Lopes, diretor do Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos, para as conclusões finais.
Muito rapidamente, eu pedi ao Dr. Henrique Freitas para ficar com as conclusões finais e, por mim, para não demorar muito tempo, apenas queria fazer duas referências. A primeira é para sublinhar, na verdade, aquilo que é a nossa convicção de que esta forma de colaboração entre um instituto como o Instituto de Estratégias Internacionais e a Assembleia da República é também um modo de contribuir para fortalecer as relações entre o Parlamento e a sociedade civil, ou seja, neste caso, entre aqueles que têm a missão, a nobre missão de legislar, e os que, através do estudo, da reflexão, da promoção do debate, podem contribuir para a formação de uma opinião pública especializada, que aqui hoje vimos amplamente representada, a olhar à volta dos participantes e identificando-os com as suas áreas de influência. É uma opinião pública especializada que, em si mesmo, pode também ajudar e, de certo modo, influenciar a tomada de posições, por parte desta importante instância de poder político que é o Parlamento. Daí que eu desejava agradecer mais uma vez ao Presidente da Comissão de Negócios Estrangeiros e Comunidades Portuguesas, não só pela iniciativa de realizar este seminário, mas também porque eu vejo nele uma espécie de adição ao ciclo de conferências que levou a cabo durante os últimos meses e em que se debateu de modo muito claro e com uma contribuição extremamente qualificada o papel de Portugal no mundo, a percepção que o mundo tem de Portugal e hoje aqui concentrada sobretudo sobre esta ideia de que é preciso pôr em evidência exatamente para perceber como dar cumprimento a essa ação externa do nosso país. Foram postas em evidência não só a complexidade atual dos conflitos a que temos de dar resposta, das suas causas, mas também foi de modo notável demonstrado e fundamentada a necessidade de criar sinergias, de encontrar respostas, que são cada vez mais complexas, quer no que respeita à organização dos mecanismos necessários para ela responder, quer inclusivamente pela necessidade de constituir sinergias entre as diversas políticas, que vão desde as políticas sociais, a política de imigração, a política de emprego, o desenvolvimento, até às políticas de segurança e defesa, mas tudo isto em função de um objetivo que hoje é cada vez mais claro neste mundo globalizado, que é o que está em causa, ao fim e ao cabo, é a segurança das pessoas. É que sejamos capazes de construir um mundo de paz, de sermos nós, os nossos países, as organizações onde pertencemos, verdadeiros atores para a paz e, desse modo, contribuir para o progresso e para o bem-estar da humanidade. É uma ambição que nunca devemos perder de vista, porque temos de trabalhar, efetivamente, na convicção de que devemos todos unir-nos e dar as mãos para obter tão importantes objetivos. Muito obrigado, mais uma vez, e muitos parabéns ao Presidente da Comissão e à Assembleia da República por ter organizado estes tão importantes e oportunos debates.
Senhor Presidente do Instituto de Estudos Estratégicos e Internacionais, Senhora Vice-Presidente, caros professores Albert Matthews e Brian Hawking, caros moderadores, ilustres convidados, e aqui sublinho a presença dos ilustres embaixadores, diplomatas, representantes do Ministério da Defesa Nacional, oficiais generais, representantes das universidades, que deram um contributo muito valioso para o sucesso desta conferência. Senhores deputados, minhas senhoras e meus senhores, de facto, quando em março do corrente ano, a Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros e Comunidades Portuguesas lançou o ciclo de conferências Pensar Portugal no Mundo, fê-lo por duas ordens de razões. Em primeiro lugar, porque estávamos convictos que existia um claro déficit de debate relativamente ao papel do nosso país na cena internacional. E, por outro lado, porque entendemos que havia uma análise muito dispersa no que respeitava à formulação de um modelo de política externa para o nosso país. E foi essa realidade, essa convicção, que nos trouxe a esta magnífica e simbólica sala do Senado um conjunto de grandes pensadores portugueses, ainda agora é que o Dr. Figueiredo Lopes teve a ocasião de referir, e que, de uma forma, direi mesmo, brilhante,
expuseram as suas ideias, levantaram questões, apontaram caminhos, desafios e deram-nos uma ideia muito precisa do que deve ser o futuro de Portugal, como parte, obviamente, integrante de um mundo global e mais, cada vez mais interdependente. Ora, depois deste momento de pensar Portugal e concretizar essa missão, sentimos a necessidade de ir mais além e de entender como é que o mundo, concretamente através de uma visão destes nossos dois ilustres oradores, desde já agradeço e felicito vivamente, viam o posicionamento do nosso país e da nossa política externa e a formulavam por parte dos Estados. Ora, não sei se fizemos um ato de diplomacia paralela, mas a verdade é que fizemos certamente um ato de democracia parlamentar e que desde já aqui sublinho. Esta democracia parlamentar ou paralela não podia ter sido feita sem o contributo inexcedível, ativo e muito participado do Instituto, como co-organizador deste evento e na pessoa, muito concretamente, do seu diretor, o meu caro amigo Figueiredo Lopes, que me habituei a conhecer, a estimar e a olhar para o seu trabalho com a maior estima pessoal e a maior consideração quando antes ambos trabalhámos no governo que fez parte, foi primeiro-ministro do Dr. João Barroso, atual presidente da Comissão Europeia. Sem a sua colaboração e sem a colaboração também dos seus investigadores, o sucesso não teria sido possível. Aqui uma palavra muito amiga de agradecimento. Nesta vida política que já vou tendo há uns certos anos, tenho vindo também a refletir, e também já passei pelo Ministério dos Negócios Estrangeiros e pelo Ministério da Defesa, tenho vindo a refletir sobre quais os instrumentos de afirmação e a projeção do nosso país. E há quatro questões com que tradicionalmente me deparo e que queria aqui convosco partilhar, de modo a podermos construir um modelo de política externa. Quais são essas questões? A primeira é tentar responder àquilo que somos. O que somos? É a pergunta. É, obviamente, uma pergunta que é um ponto de partida para o sucesso de qualquer relação entre Portugal e a comunidade internacional. Funciona, aliás, devo dizer, como um processo quase de autoconhecimento. Conhecermos e termos consciência da nossa identidade, dos nossos valores e da nossa dimensão. Porque muitas vezes, e terão consciência disso, acreditamos que somos os maiores e que temos mais influência do que aquilo que verdadeiramente corresponde à nossa realidade, e essa é uma perspectiva. Depois há outra, que é aquela de não tomarmos consciência de que o nosso passado histórico, o nosso percurso histórico, dá-nos uma dimensão internacional superior, porventura, ao nosso peso demográfico ou ao nosso peso geográfico. Aliás, a nossa valia do nosso passado, visto aqui como um passaporte para o nosso diálogo entre a comunidade internacional. A segunda questão também parece óbvia e prende-se com o que é que Portugal, de facto, pretende obter do nosso relacionamento com o mundo. E, obviamente, as parcerias com os Estados terceiros ou a integração em estruturas supranacionais, como é o caso da União Europeia, que tem sido um fator decisivo da nossa modernidade e que tem impulsionado de uma forma relevante as nossas relações com os nossos espaços naturais de afinidade, os PALOPs, o Brasil ou o Mediterrâneo. A terceira é de que forma nos desejamos relacionar com a sociedade internacional. E aqui é muito importante ter a primeira questão muito clara na nossa cabeça de quem somos. Portugal tem uma tradição notável em termos de práticas diplomáticas, desde a fundação do Estado português até aos nossos dias e mesmo antes, quando a construção desta chamada realidade lusa, sempre tivemos uma postura acutilante e eficaz perante o mundo. Contudo, o mundo mudou muito. O mundo global, como dizer-se, rápida mudança, onde as receitas do passado dificilmente terão sucesso. Mas há um produto português, e que foi referido até nas nossas conferências, que é o produto chamado língua, a cultura portuguesa. E essa é algo que nos dá uma mais-valia importante. Se olharmos para Fernando Pessoa, Vieira da Silva, o Manuel de Oliveira, já com 100 anos, mas muito vivo, ou a presença de grandes escritores, Saramago, ou o irmão do nosso Estado de Estado, o António Lobo Antunes, também sempre candidato a Prémio Nobel, ou também numa capacidade de ver a cultura muito mais larga, como aqui foi citado, não falamos do Mourinho ou do Cristiano Ronaldo, que são também peças da nossa influência, desta nossa realidade lusa. E é isso, são formas de nos realizarmos com o mundo, também temos, são instrumentos da nossa política externa. E por fim, a última questão, que não é nossa, mas é de todos, que é o resultado imediato das boas ou más políticas internas ou externas de cada país, é que mundo desejamos. E a esta pergunta temos uma resposta que nos obriga a focarmos na nossa essência e a pensarmos naquilo que desejamos e consideramos ser melhor para o nosso país. E aí, peço a ideia na analogia doméstica de um grande autor, académico, Hidemi Suganami, entendida como a projeção das práticas e do funcionamento do modelo interno de um Estado para o plano internacional, poderá ser, é uma hipótese, neste contexto examinada, naquilo que é acreditar ser útil, benéfico e eficaz dentro do nosso Estado e que será certamente bom para toda a comunidade internacional no respeito pelos direitos humanos e pela preservação, porventura, do meio ambiente. Ora, nesta atual conjuntura mundial, muito bem definida e colocada nos termos exatos pelos nossos oradores, desconhecer a importância de uma política externa e de uma eficaz ação diplomática equivale a desconhecer que a sobrevivência de um país e o seu desenvolvimento estão diretamente associados ao grau de integração que este tem na comunidade internacional. Daí este nosso contributo da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros e Comunidades Portuguesas, chamando para isso também a sociedade civil, aqui representada pelo Instituto. Dito isto, acredito firmemente que Portugal não sofre, ou melhor, nós pretendemos aqui demonstrar que Portugal não sofre deste desconhecimento e que a política externa é uma prioridade nacional. Contudo, o reconhecer desta importância não nos pode tornar, em momento algum, menos atentos, menos ambiciosos e menos ativos. Foi o que aqui pretendemos demonstrar nesta conferência internacional. Agradeço, pois, a vossa presença em nome da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros e Comunidades Portuguesas. Desejo que este seja o primeiro de outras realizações, porque este sucesso só faz sentido se o repetirmos. Muito obrigado.